only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host and friend Jim Lafferty is still overseas traveling for the summer, but he'll be back in just a few more weeks. In the meantime, we've got a great show lined up for you today. In our first half hour, we'll welcome back a great environmental and climate justice advocate, LA's Chief Heat Officer Marta Segura. We'll be talking about the city's efforts to make sure all of our diverse communities stay safe during this summer's record-breaking heat waves, which are due to start as early as this weekend. Then, in our second half hour, I'll be joined by attorney Shayla Myers from Legal Aid Foundation's Unhoused People's Justice Project. We'll look at one of the big Supreme Court decisions made this week. No, not the one about how a sitting president can do almost anything and not be convicted of a crime, but rather the one where the Supreme Court gives cities the right to criminalize people for sleeping in public, even if they have no other options. Given that there are hundreds of thousands of unsheltered people in the U.S. at any given moment, this important story is getting less coverage than it deserves, so please stay tuned for that. Okay, jumping right into our first segment. Los Angeles is known for having some of the best weather in the world. Woo! I mean, that's one of the reasons it's so crowded, right? And why it's so darn expensive to live here. We've got the weather. Well, unfortunately, even LA won't be spared from the extreme heat that's being predicted throughout the country. In our San Gabriel and San Fernando valleys, and of course the deserts, temperatures are expected to soar to triple digits as early as this weekend, and possibly for extended lengths of time. And as we know, even temperatures in the mid-80s and 90s can be miserable and dangerous for people stuck inside without air conditioning. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass warned of the extreme heat in a statement to the press yesterday, announcing, quote, "This summer has the potential to be the hottest summer on record, and the city will be taking immediate action to ensure Angelenos are safe." So what kind of immediate action is the mayor referring to? Well, we're so lucky to have with us someone who can talk about just that, what the city and community advocates are together doing to educate and protect the people of LA so that we're all better equipped collectively to deal with extreme heat and other climate emergencies that are, let's face it, inevitable. Our guest today is Marta Segura, who serves as the City of LA's Chief Heat Officer and Director of the City's Climate Emergency Mobilization Office. Marta is one of just a handful of Chief Heat Officers worldwide, so LA definitely represents globally. Before becoming LA's first Chief Heat Officer, Marta was already a policy thought leader in environmental and climate justice, as well as in the field of public health and promoting healthier and more engaged communities. So today, Marta is spearheading partnerships all throughout LA to develop the city's climate vulnerability assessment, heat action plan, local hazard mitigation plan, and climate action plan. Marta is committed to connecting community voices to achieve healthier, thriving, climate-adapted communities and shaping equitable climate policy for the city and, I would argue, for the world. Marta Segura, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show. Hope you're on mute, though.
Oh, thank you, Maria, for inviting me back. I'm really excited to be here because you help us get the message out there to make sure people understand how different summer is, and we now call it heat season. And you're right, it has the potential to be the hottest summer ever. And Mayor Bass has been a phenomenal support. I think you're asking me what kinds of things are we doing now that we didn't do before. I actually feel that perhaps because, you know, this role exists, but I have some phenomenal collaboration at the City of LA. General Manager of Parks at the Emergency Management Department has been a phenomenal partner and collaborator. Of course, Mayor Bass and Deputy Mayor Sutley have been super supportive. They want to prioritize extreme heat as a climate issue and hazard under the climate cabinet. So we're starting a committee within the new climate cabinet for addressing extreme heat and climate resilience, which means now that it's not just a position that coordinates with other departments, but it has the support of the Office of the Mayor moving forward so that when we create our heat action plan, we have the framework now, but when we actually get the other general managers engaged and decide on our final framing for the heat action plan, the mayor's stamp will be behind it, right? And they will be equally engaged in formulating what the city's heat action plan will be. And if I'm not mistaken, we'll probably be the first city in the West Coast with a heat action plan. And it's closely based off of the state's extreme heat program, but with four tracks, which are, let me see here, creating public awareness for extreme heat. And ours will be with an equity-focused early notification system. We also want to strengthen our heat response and emergency response with community resilience services and with community. We want to ensure that we increase heat resilience for our built environment and transportation systems, because that's really important. We can talk a little bit more about that later, how air pollution and wildfires combined with extreme heat exacerbate issues, particularly in communities without air conditioning, right? So that's going to be really important. The other track that we're following from the states is having nature-based solutions, ensuring that we have an equitable distribution of tree canopy, equitable distribution of vegetation, because that's super important in the longevity and the health of these communities across Los Angeles. And we want to make sure that we focus in on the areas that don't have them, and develop a citywide, this is the one that we added, developing a citywide monitoring and tracking system to have additional governance, right? Because we have all these plans and we have lovely plans across the nation and the state, but they don't have a monitoring, many of them don't have a monitoring and tracking system, and ours will. And that's what's going to create more transparency, more accountability. And I'm really excited about that additional track. In fact, we had people at the state say, wow, we should add that one to our plan as well. That's a little bit about the long-term planning and why I think this administration has been so phenomenal in integrating this issue as a priority. But you also asked what we're doing differently for this heat wave. In my 3 years in this role, this is the most prepared, coordinated conversation and meetings we have had across departments and emergency operations to prepare for this heat wave. So I was really impressed that we started earlier and that we actually discussed, you know, how many cooling centers we need, where do we need them, what other resources can we provide, and we collected all the resources that we needed for the unhoused, that we needed across the city, and also to help people be aware that the City of LA already has 70 plus libraries that operate as cooling centers, and eight of them are open on Sundays. Wow. And then this year, the City Council just approved opening an additional three in areas of greatest heat risk on Sundays as well. And then if you combine that with the county's libraries and rec centers, we have over 200 facilities region-wide where people can go to cool off from extreme heat. Now, we found in our research that a lot of people still don't know that, right? They are unaware that our public facilities are available to them for cooling off, rehydrating, filling up their water bottles. And that's the other thing. Now we have hydration systems and stations at every single public library, right? Wow. So you could take your water bottle into any public library, fill it up, take a break, read a book, cool off, because our bodies really need to cool off during these extreme temperatures. And I guess I'll repeat what I've said before. Mm-hmm. Heat waves are more frequent, they last longer, and they're more dangerous. because of their duration, right? This heat wave actually starts today and it goes all the way through Monday. And if you can imagine, your body needs to recover. And if it remains hot at night in particular, your body needs intentional recovery. So you need to seek out not just shade, but cooling and hydration. And if you feel any, you know, dizziness or something that's really off that you have not felt before, for example, dryness of the mouth, exhaustion, excessive exhaustion, those are all hints that your body's trying to tell you that you are getting heat exhaustion or on the path towards heat exhaustion or heat injury. I myself take electrolytes during a heat wave so that I don't have to worry about being drinking too much water, because you can drink too much water too, apparently. And I was made aware of that during my research. So
if the chief heat officer does it, then I'm going to take that as a pro tip.
It's a pro tip, yes. So if we recognize that these heat waves are much more dangerous than when we were kids, right? Then we should plan ahead. We should create a buddy system. If you have vulnerable people in your family with existing health conditions like asthma or heart disease or any kind of, you know, pre-existing illness, those people need special attention too. Babies and elders, for example, have more vulnerabilities than adults.
I really
think that, you know, this press release that you were referring to listed a lot of our resources, and then we're releasing something else that specifically states all of the resources in Skid Row.
I'm going to ask you that.
We're going to get there. Okay. All right. I'll stop.
So I just love your passion talking about it, because I did want to ask about that specifically about, you know, kind of from an environmental justice lens or climate justice lens. Mm-hmm. You know, the sun, of course, shines over all of us. So whether you're in Skid Row or on Rodeo Drive, the sun is hot, but it doesn't impact everyone equally, as you were just saying. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about the vulnerable people out there, whether it's their physical condition or due to poverty or some other conditions? Why are they more vulnerable, and what other options are there?
Yeah, what we know from some national studies is that approximately 50% of the people who perish during heat waves are the unhoused, right? The other percentage are the vulnerable communities that live in low-income areas that lack air conditioning, likely pollution burdened because they have these pre-existing health conditions. And, you know, they don't have knowledge of where to go for refuge. And some of them are immobile. Like if you're disabled, if you're elderly and you can't move out of your apartment, those are the people that we really want to have buddy systems for, so that there's somebody in their neighborhood or somebody on their floor that knocks on the door and finds out if they need anything. You know, they may not have water. They may not have running water or something else. We need to be really good neighbors and pay attention to our community. So I think that what we realize as a city is that there are these historically disinvested areas that lack AC and other infrastructure, who desperately need resources like cooling centers and resilience hubs, and for us to ensure that we're providing shade structures and hydration stations and more tree canopy to make those neighborhoods more livable and walkable, not just now, but in the future, right? Mm-hmm. So many of these are short-term solutions, but some of them are actually long-term solutions that also address our climate issues, right? And I think that if we invest first and foremost in these vulnerable communities, not only do we get improved numbers of reducing death, preventable death, and preventable injury, but we also can accelerate climate solutions for everyone, for the entire region. Because if you can imagine, you know, planting more vegetation, planting more trees, ensuring that folks have affordable energy and electricity to have ACs, we're gonna see an improvement for the entire city, not just for that particular neighborhood, right?
Right. And you can see different temperature, you know, now that we all have, or a lot of us have the thermometer in our car, that you can read the external temperature. And it never ceases to amaze me that when I'm on the freeway surrounded by asphalt, it just goes sky high. And then when you're in other areas with more trees, it does drop. You know, we have all these microclimates.
That's right.
Yeah. And so speaking of that, you know, you were saying like in some areas like Skid Row, it's just surrounded by pavement. You're going to mention something about that, some other cooling stations and things.
Yeah. So yeah, Skid Row is definitely a concrete jungle, urban heat island. So we have some permanent climate stations there. Wow. That are there year round. This year, we're adding an additional permanent climate station and one additional temporary station. In addition to that, the Bureau of Street Services went and checked to make sure all of their six hydration stations are working. And then we have hydration stations at the parks that are near Skid Row that are also functioning. I want to make it clear to folks out there, there are two that aren't functioning, but this mayor has made it a priority to get those operable as soon as possible. But already now there's more available resources on Skid Row than there was last summer. And we were really, you know, every year we want to see more improvements. That still may not be enough, but we want to make sure that we continue to add. But we're really mind shifting too, that they can use libraries as well. Our general manager for libraries, John Szabo, is a phenomenal humanist, and he sees every individual as a patron of the libraries, and he wants everybody to go in there and rest, read a book, get some water, feel at home. So we have that little Tokyo Service Center library, and that's also available to our unhoused community. They can also go to the central library, and many of them do. And we will have, through the Homeless Healthcare LA and Urban Alchemy, we will be distributing water bottles and other cooling kits so that they can go refill as many times as they want. And that's in addition to the nonprofits that already exist there that also provide resources.
Right. And I'll give a shout out to the LA Law Library, because they too, they welcome everyone to come in, and it's a great resource. And there's, you know, free access to computers and all kinds of things. It's very nice and cool with AC.
Yeah. And I don't take it for granted that our libraries, including the LA Law Library, are available, because other cities, and I won't name names, but other cities are not offering their libraries to everyone, which is, you know, so I'm grateful to be in this environment and in this city with such collaborative partnerships, not just in the city, but also the nonprofits that we work with. So I haven't talked about that. Maybe you're going to ask me a question, but we do have a Heat Relief for LA campaign. Yeah. And so we're distributing materials that we printed, thousands and thousands of materials, to nonprofit organizations to share with their community health educators. Some of them are door knocking. Some of them are distributing at events. Some of them are distributing at the meetings that they're having with community members. So we're really excited about that. And our campaign is multilingual, right?
Yes, I was about to ask you that too. Okay. And I was going to segue from the libraries to multilingual.
Okay. All right.
But I wanted to hear. I was really excited to see that. I saw it on your LinkedIn, actually, about the multilingual campaign, because how many languages do we speak here in LA? Like over 200 or something.
That's
and
right.
Some are, you know, some, if you speak one, you can speak like five or at least read five or six more. But yeah, there are so many people who get left out because of their language. So yeah, please do tell us a little more about that.
Sure. Well, we're really fortunate to have had, you know, our materials translated into 15 different languages digitally, and into 8 languages in print. And then our public service announcement on the bus shelters is in 4 different languages: Korean, Chinese, English, and Spanish. So, and then we geographically targeted areas across the city so that they were placed in areas where that language was a dominant language, right? So, you know, each year we will get a little bit better. The other thing I'm really proud of is it's a Loteria, culturally relevant, you know, art created by the iconic artist Lalo Alcaraz.
Wow.
And he's posting it all over social media. And so are other folks. Whenever, you know, a resident sees our picture, they're welcome to take a picture of themselves with the poster and repost it on social media. So some folks have been doing that as well. And they love it because it's colorful, it's visual. You don't have to read it to understand it, although it is multilingual as well, right? So I encourage folks to look out for bus shelters where it says avoid heat stroke or evite la insolación solar in Spanish. And I don't know how to say it in Korean, or I would.
Yeah. We'll learn. There's Google Translate. We can try.
There's Google Translate. So I welcome folks to go to climateforla.org/heat relief, and they'll find our materials, our digital materials there.
Cool. And for those listeners just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall. This is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. And I'm speaking with LA's Chief Heat Officer, Marta Segura. And I also wanted to ask, while we still have a couple minutes or a few minutes, about LA as being, because I do have LA pride, you know, I want to talk about global efforts and how LA has been in the forefront of these worldwide ideas, exchanging ideas, and you know, this, because of course the climate, the extreme weather, it is affecting all of us on our planet. So that should affect all of us. And if we can, you know, your connections and your ideas and what you're seeing make work can help other places, and what they do can help us, you know, talk about that. Talk about the other heat officers around the world. What are you kind of getting inspiration from? What kinds of ideas, what kind of new technologies are there?
Great. Yeah. Well, I have, I'm part of a couple of cohorts. One is called 10 Across, which is basically resilience officers and heat officers from Los Angeles to Jacksonville, Florida. So we cover the entire Sun Belt and the 10 freeway, right? Wow. And I have learned so much from them. My colleagues in Mobile, Alabama, Jacksonville, Florida, you think, you know, this is the South, you know, LA is going to be more, much more, you know, advanced. Our perceptions could be warped, though, because I was so impressed by these resilience officers. They're also doing community engagement. They're also doing, you know, focus groups to ensure that the community is co-designing some of the solutions with them. They are basing their investments and advocacy for investments on demographics as well. And it's really encouraging to see this equitable approach being applied in areas of the Sun Belt that you 10 years ago may not have seen, right? So I think that's number one. So I don't just count other chief heat officers as my colleagues. I count all resilience officers and sustainability officers and others too that are making these changes without the appropriate title. I all my respect to them, because LA is fortunate that we have a chief heat officer, right? So not every city or every township can have that opportunity. And you were asking me what kinds of technologies or what kinds of innovations I'm seeing. I think that, you know, cool surfaces are really key, right? Because we can't put tree canopy everywhere. I'm a real fan of cool roofs, though, because cool roofs lower your energy costs. They cool off the building, and they radiate back towards the heavens, right? Whereas if you have cool pavement, while you're walking on it, it tends to get hotter because it's re-radiating the heat during the daytime. So my preference for cool surfaces is obviously cool roofs. But I think we need a multifaceted approach, and we need different technologies. So for example, you can imagine a neighborhood that has cool roofs, that has more shade structures, bus shelters, hydration stations, more tree canopy, more vegetation, native plants, and a combination of cool materials that are part of these buildings to reduce their emissions, but also to create a passive cooling, right? So we have to look at materials and building performance standards to ensure all of these different types of opportunities and investments are working together to reshape our city and make it a much cooler one and more livable one.
Well, shout out some of the, you know, what I assume you visited some of these other cities.
Actually, no, I've I've been traveling, but I actually haven't been to these cities. I mean, I've obviously been to Phoenix before, but not to visit my colleague, Chief Heat Officer David Hondula, who's phenomenal and a mentor, and I learned so much from him. And also shout out to Jane Gilbert in Miami-Dade. I just saw her in Aspen. We were on a panel together on about extreme heat with author David Goodall, who wrote the book, The Heat Will Kill You First. Wow. And I have not been to these cities, but I have been reading their newsletters and I have been reading, you know, the work that they're doing. I learned about this heat safety partnership and network from Phoenix. They did it first, where they collaborated with nonprofit organizations and businesses to distribute information and heat relief materials. And I'm like, I definitely want to do that. So we've begun that effort with nonprofit organizations. I think next year I want to invite more businesses to be a part of it, but it's a growing network and growing set of partnerships that have been built because they inspired me to do that. And then my colleague, Jane Gilbert, has really worked on worker health and safety and heat issues in Miami-Dade. And I admire that because, as you know, Florida is in a state where the governor himself does not advocate for protections for workers. In fact, he reversed protections for workers in Florida. So, you know, in Los Angeles and in California, Cal OSHA has jurisdiction over extreme heat. Fortunately, they just passed new standards or voted on new standards at Cal OSHA to protect the indoor air of workers. And we want to see how that can trickle down to Los Angeles and how LA can help convey these new standards to employers, not just those who contract with us, but, you know, employers overall in Los Angeles. So a lot of what we do is communications and risk communications and ensuring people are having conversations about this, because yes, we need systems change and we need municipalities and cities to reshape the city and create better emergency response and awareness. But then the other responsibility lies on us, so that we can protect ourselves, our families, and our communities, right? And
right,
that's
our neighbors.
Yeah.
Like, and you said about that, having a buddy system, people who live close by, you know who maybe the older people are, people with disabilities, people who may not have access to that other support.
Exactly. And we just live in a new world, right? Where we just had the pandemic that taught us a lot of things about how to be aware of our bodies and self-care and create these buddy systems, create these community systems for responding to disaster. So we want to apply those lessons to extreme heat and extreme weather as a whole, right?
Absolutely. It's so funny. You're already answering the questions that I had in my mind, but it's like just naturally organic.
I love your questions though. So please ask them because they make me think of other things. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm fascinated by it. I am so proud that LA is, you know, I mean, of course I have my you know, complaints about LA about other things, but I love that the city hired you, because I have known you for decades and I know you're legit. I know you're out there hearing people and, you know, getting as diverse of voices as you can.
So, thank you, Maria. Feeling is mutual. You're super legit. I really appreciate the space, you know, to be able to talk with somebody and a colleague that I really respect. And yeah, we're kind of on the same page. We have the same vision and solutions in our minds are similar, I should say. So we follow each other's brainwaves here.
Yeah. We've seen the power of the people. I definitely trust the people on the ground more than I trust most people who are way, way, way high up there. So yeah.
We really need a ground truth everything. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. I really appreciate that this role has allowed me to continue to work closely with, you know, nonprofit organizations. Shout out to PSRLA, Proclaim a Beautiful, Lane, Communities for a Better Environment, so many, Black Women for Wellness, that Homeless Healthcare LA. There's about 40 organizations, so I apologize for not mentioning all of you that have been instrumental, right, in shaping our heat action framework, in designing our community assembly, the materials that we're sharing, and improving the governance and decision-making process so that their opinions matter as we develop new policies for the city of Los Angeles. And I always look forward to what they have to say and how we can integrate that for better, more ground truth solutions in Los Angeles.
Amazing. Well, that was a perfect way to end our, it always goes too fast, but I do want to ask you last question, which is how can people find out more? How can they get involved?
Sure. Right. Go to climateforla.org. My whole team is on there. Any member of my team can help you out and have a conversation with you. I will too. So you can, if you want to meet with me or if you want to meet with other members of my team, just email us and let us know. And hopefully you could check out all of our materials and all of our resources there as well. And if you ever want to come to City Hall, we can coordinate that for you and make sure that you get parking and you can meet with us and you know, get your tour of City Hall.
Oh, that's great. And we do have a lot of community organizers who listen. So definitely bring your whole crew.
Definitely. That's what we're there for. City Hall is open for business.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, Marta Segura, City of LA's Chief Heat Officer and Director of Climate Emergency Mobilization Office.
That's right.
I got that straight. Otherwise known as CEMO. Thank you. I can't wait to have you on again. Hopefully it'll be all good and we won't have any disasters, knock on wood.
Knock on wood.
Yes. Let's just keep spreading the word on how to stay safe out there.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you. Have a safe one. Take care.
You too. Bye. Well, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, The Lawyers Guild Show. We are going to take a 30-second break, and then please stay tuned because we have another great segment coming up.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the serving California and beyond.
Okay, we are back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show, KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Maria Hall. And now we are going to turn to the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh, duck and cover. Well, they handed down several major decisions in the past 5 days. One of the most talked about, of course, is Trump versus United States, where the 6 conservative justices decided to give broad immunity from criminal prosecution to sitting presidents. But while that's grabbing headlines on the national stage, there was a decision on Friday by those same 6 justices that will arguably have a more immediate and potentially deadly impact on hundreds of thousands of people living in the U.S. at this very moment. In Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson, the Supreme Court gave carte blanche to cities to punish, fine, and even jail people for sleeping outside, even if they have no other option. This overturned the 9th Circuit case that decided that was cruel and unusual punishment and therefore unconstitutional. Well, to talk about what all this means, I'm so happy to have with us today attorney Shayla Myers with the Legal Aid Foundation of LA's Unhoused People's Justice Project. Shayla works on issues related to housing and homelessness with a special focus on the criminalization of homelessness and poverty. Shayla works in the courtroom and on the ground to advocate for the rights of low-income and unsheltered communities. Shayla Myers, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Maria, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, yes. So let's get down to it. In broad strokes, what were the legal issues presented to the U.S. Supreme Court in Grants Pass versus Johnson?
Well, the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, which has about 38,000 people and about 600 unhoused folks, passed an ordinance that made it a crime to camp anywhere within the Grants Pass jurisdiction, which meant that unhoused folks who had no other choice but to sleep outside were criminally responsible for sleeping outside. They were violating the law just simply by existing in Grants Pass. And so a group of unhoused folks in Oregon challenged that ordinance, arguing that it violated the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. They won. They won at the Ninth Circuit as well. And Grants Pass challenged that decision to the United States Supreme Court, asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on this, what turned out to be a really narrow question, which is whether or not the Eighth Amendment prohibits punishing people for sleeping outside when they have no place else to go, and specifically whether or not it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment to do that. And of course, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court said, no, it doesn't. In, again, another divided 6-3 decision with the conservative side siding with the city of Grants Pass. And the liberal side, led by Justice Sotomayor, really articulating, I think, the, sort of the heart and soul of this issue, which is the implications that it will have for unhoused folks.
Right. And before, and I do want to get into that as well. But before that, when was this original lawsuit and who were kind of the advocates behind it? I seem to remember, you know, amicus briefs being filed and, you know, kind of it making headlines all around the country when this originally was brought to the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit, actually.
Yeah, I mean, this case was filed in the, I believe it was filed in 2021, but it was a case that followed up, as you said, in Martin versus City of Boise, which is sort of that underlying decision. And that was brought by advocates in Idaho challenging it. Although I think we have to say, and this is a shout out to the National Lawyers Guild and to Carol Sobel, who's been a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. Carol Sobel and the ACLU of Southern California brought sort of the original case related to this, which is Jones versus City of LA. And that was a case that really led the way in reasoning that these kinds of ordinances violated the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. But the Oregon case stemmed from, there's a legal services organization, a really amazing group in Oregon, Oregon Legal Services, that represented the unhoused folks in that case. And so it was really, you know, it was really a group of unhoused folks coming together and standing up for their rights, saying that what was happening in Oregon was not okay.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. Okay, so now let's talk about the issues that were presented in the U.S. Supreme Court. And who was, again, I'm asking you because I genuinely am flabbergasted by the varying sides that, you know, it wasn't the usual cast like, oh yeah, everyone on the left of center, you know, was on this side and everyone on the right of center was on this side. It was not like that, right? So can you tell us, like, kind of what were the different viewpoints, the different sides of the dispute, and what public figures were kind of siding on which side?
Sure. I think what really happens when it comes to the criminalization of homelessness, and I think what really happens at the very local level, which is where these issues are really decided, sort of block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood, is that sort of all politics are conservative on this issue. And so even in jurisdictions like Los Angeles, which we would tend to think of as fairly progressive, generally tends to actually be fairly conservative on this issue. So this case garnered more amicus support from around the country than I have heard than any other case. And what really happened was cities and states weighed in, irrespective of the political leanings of those jurisdictions, on behalf of Grants Pass. Originally, when Grants Pass was seeking cert from the United States Supreme Court, Gavin Newsom, our governor, obviously in California, the city of San Francisco and the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles, I'm sorry, not the county, the city of San Francisco and Los Angeles and Gavin Newsom all weighed in asking the Supreme Court to take up the case. Something interesting happened when it actually got in front of the Supreme Court, which is those jurisdictions and the county of Los Angeles said, we actually don't support overturning Martin. We do think it's cruel and unusual punishment to punish people for sleeping outside when they have no place else to go. Wink, wink, nod, nod. But we think that you should clarify what the law is. But at that point, all of these jurisdictions had already advocated this Supreme Court, the Supreme Court that's pretty well known for stripping people's constitutional rights away. They already asked this Supreme Court to take up the case. And so I think a lot of folks feel like by doing that, places like Los Angeles and, you know, Governor Newsom tipped their hand, even if they ultimately took a more nuanced middle ground in the case.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because not, I mean, now it is making even more headlines. So now more people, I would imagine, are knowledgeable about the case, whereas back then, maybe it wasn't so known to voters.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's also really important to know that when we ask a conservative Supreme Court to take up an issue, obviously the city of Los Angeles and the city and county of San Francisco and, you know, Gavin Newsom can't determine how the Supreme Court is going to rule on this issue, which I think a lot of people pointed out related particularly to the city of Los Angeles. You know, what business is it of the city of Los Angeles, this seemingly progressive city, to ask this court to take up the constitutional rights of a group of folks? I think important to note, particularly at a time when places like Los Angeles politicians in Los Angeles are very outspoken about this Supreme Court stripping people of their reproductive rights.
Right. And, you know, I should have asked you to, just to clarify, can you just explain in a couple sentences about what an amicus brief is?
Sure. Amicus briefs are friends of the court brief. And basically what it is when you file a lawsuit, there's the plaintiff and the defendant, and they get to shape what the legal issues are. And then they, you know, depending on how the district court goes, it'll get appealed to the circuit court and then sometimes to the Supreme Court. But obviously, when the Supreme Court decides an issue, it's going to have a broader impact than just on the parties in the case. So what the Supreme Court ruled in this case was going to have a much broader impact than just on the 600 people in Grants Pass. And so people can weigh in, even if they're not parties to the case, by filing what's called a friend of the court brief or an amicus brief. And that brief is really just to state a position that's maybe not taken by the parties. So lots and lots and lots of folks all around the country filed these amicus briefs. And actually, Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion, commented on the fact that so many local jurisdictions and states had filed amicus briefs, really asking the court for, quote, help in addressing the issues that they say the Ninth Circuit created by protecting unhoused folks' civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, they're saying, hey, help us keep our power.
Exactly. They were saying that, you know, that this decision, the Martin decision, stripped cities and counties and states of their power to address the homelessness crisis. We know that's not what happened. Certainly, that decision took away exactly one tool for those cities and counties, i.e. throwing people in jail. But that was certainly the argument that they made.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's get into what the justices ultimately decided, or I should say more what they wrote. So the majority opinion that is now the law of the land, and then the dissent. Talk a little bit about that, please.
Sure. Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. And what he really focused on in writing the majority opinion was the scope of the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment prohibition. So the Eighth Amendment says cities and states can't engage in cruel and unusual punishment. And what Justice Gorsuch said was that the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment provision should be understood to be really about punishment. We should use that to analyze the scope of whether or not, after you're convicted of a crime, the punishment that you receive, whether that is cruel and unusual or whether that's reasonable under our understanding of punishment. And so he said, in Grants Pass, if you violate this ordinance, you're subject to a fine. And after escalating punishment, maybe you're subject to a few days in jail. But no one would expect that jail or fines are themselves cruel and unusual. And so he really wanted to limit the scope of the Eighth Amendment to just about what happens after you go through the criminal justice system and you're really facing punishment. The reason why, and looking at the plain language of the Eighth Amendment, that may carry some resonance for some folks, that the Eighth Amendment is really just about cruel and unusual punishment. The problem is the United States Supreme Court in the 1970s, it issued a decision, in this case, Robinson versus California. And what the court in Robinson said was that it is cruel and unusual punishment to punish someone for their status. In that case, there was a law in California that made it a crime to be an addict. It didn't punish someone for engaging in behavior related to being an addict, but it literally said it punished people for the status of being an addict. And so the court said even a day in jail or a dollar fine is cruel and unusual if it's for the status of being, right? And so that's how the court put together that it violated the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. And so in this case, folks argued and the Ninth Circuit agreed that if you punish someone for sleeping outside, then they literally have no place else to go. A person sleeping is a biological imperative. You can't not sleep. And so when you punish someone for sleeping outside, it's not that you're punishing them for sleeping, you're really punishing them for being unhoused. And that was the Ninth Circuit's reasoning related to this and how it fit in. And Justice Gorsuch said that that was a bridge too far for reading Robinson, that it really, they really understood the Eighth Amendment to be about punishment, and that Robinson was a really narrow exception that this did not fall under. I mean, I think that is a, that is obviously one particular reading. I think Justice Sotomayor did a very good job in her dissent of explaining that actually our understanding of the Eighth Amendment is broader than that, that there are, there is a whole other line of cases beyond Robinson that that contemplates what it means to substantively punish folks for crimes. But at the end of the day, Justice Gorsuch won the day, obviously, with a 6-3 majority opinion.
Mm-hmm. And can you comment also on, because there has been a lot on social media, people, you know, arguing one thing or the other. I know that some people have, you know, they look at the elements that they don't like that are maybe, you know, antisocial behavior by some people, unhoused people, or, you know, different things like, you know, whatever they're complaining about, whether that be, you know, a smell or, you know, different things like that. But can you talk about how, when you have such a far-reaching Supreme Court decision, you know, doesn't that also impact people who are fleeing from their abuser and don't have a place to go? Like, can you talk a little bit about that, about why, when people make sweeping generalizations, like, how does that impact when you have, you know, such a broad policy?
Well, I mean, I think irrespective of whether it's going to impact one population or another, it's going to broadly impact unhoused folks, irrespective of why they are unhoused. But also the reality is unhoused folks are criminals in our society only because we have passed laws that say that they are criminal. And I think that's one of those things that is really hard to stomach about the way we think about criminalization in our society, right? We have this idea that folks who are unhoused are criminals. That is only the case because we've written laws that make it a crime to be outside, that ultimately this Supreme Court said is constitutional under the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment provision. And the reality is that what was at issue in front of the Supreme Court was actually a very, very narrow prohibition. It prohibited jurisdictions from punishing people for sleeping outside when they have no place else to go. People say, and a lot of jurisdictions say, well, we need this kind of law that punishes people for sleeping outside so that we can force them to go into shelter. But that is a straw man argument, because the prohibition didn't extend to instances in which people had shelter available to them. The protection was really only about those instances where people have no place else to go, when they literally had no choice but to sleep outside, and biologically to sleep outside. And in Grants Pass, the court in Grants Pass extended it a little farther than sleeping, because they said, well, you also can't punish people for having protection against the most rudimentary protections against the elements. So you can have a tarp, or you can have a blanket if it's freezing cold outside. And you know, the justices really keyed into that to punish people, saying that, well, it's their choice to have a blanket.
Well, for listeners just tuning in, this is Maria Hall. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with attorney Shayla Myers. Okay, so let's bring it back to LA. We'd mentioned that, you know, originally certain of our local governments had said, yes, Supreme Court, please take this case and give us guidance. But then since then, I know Mayor Bass was one that condemned the decision, arguing that the opinion will criminalize homelessness. So what might this mean for the, you know, advocates here in town, for unsheltered communities here, and then let alone in other governments that are, you know, even less progressive?
Mayor Bass has actually been very consistent when the city about not wanting the Supreme Court to take up this case or to strike down the central holding in Martin and Grants Pass. When the city attorney, Heidi Feldstein Soto, made the decision to file a brief on behalf of the city of Los Angeles asking the Supreme Court to take up the case, Mayor Bass was clear that she did not support the Supreme Court taking up the case. Oh. That's an interesting thing about Los Angeles. So in the county of Los Angeles, the Board of Supervisors votes on the position of the county for purposes of amicus briefs. Here in the city of Los Angeles, the elected city attorney makes that decision. And so the city council members never voted on their position on the amicus brief. Heidi Feldstein Soto was simply able to file an amicus brief on behalf of the city, taking a position asking this Supreme Court to consider the issue in Grants Pass. I point that out, though, because I think important to note, council member Eunices Hernandez, who happens to be my council member in CD1, she signed on to an amicus brief on behalf of progressive elected officials, both present and past elected officials, and pointing out that criminalization is not a successful policy choice, should not be the choice that jurisdictions rely on to address the homelessness crisis. So certainly there is this issue is divisive within the city council itself. Different city council members have taken very different positions. And obviously, our city attorney has taken a different position than our mayor. So,
wow. Right. Last week, we had a show on the Barrington Plaza evictions. And luckily, they're not getting evicted, the Tenants Association. But yeah, in that one, Tracy Park was not taking a stance to keep those people housed, I'll just say.
Yeah.
Throwing that out there. So yeah, I know they're very different. But that is good. So going back to the question of, you know, what might that mean locally? Is it again going to be, are we kind of in the same boat? Do you think LA will be any different as a result, or is it kind of going to be status quo?
Well, so I think, LA has been really, really nuanced in how it criminalizes homelessness for the past few decades. They certainly have not stop criminalizing homelessness, even though they were subject to a settlement agreement in Jones versus City of LA, that early case I mentioned related to this. Important to note, though, the City of Los Angeles does not have a citywide anti-camping ban like the one that was implicated in Grants Pass versus Johnson. The city of LA used to have an anti-camping ordinance, and that was reformed. It was changed in 2020 and 2021. To just prohibit camping in certain locations. And the City of Los Angeles's analysis was that it was consistent with Grants Pass and Martin. And you know, that was never challenged to a decision. So I think the City of Los Angeles, in order for Grants Pass to have an implication here at the local level in the city, would have to pass a citywide anti-camping ordinance. And I think that's one of those things that voters are obviously paying attention to when they think about the city council and other, and other races is what will that actually look like? Because members of the city council, led by Councilmember Park, but also signed on to by Councilmember Kevin DeLeon, Karen Price, Bob Blumenfield, different council members signed on to a motion. I believe it was Councilmember Blumenfield signed on to a motion asking the city attorney's office to weigh in about what steps they could take in the wake of Grants Pass. Now, the city is subject to lots of settlement agreements. Also, they're subject to ongoing litigation by my team and others related to their criminalization. I don't think Grants Pass will have an impact on that. And I think, you know, politicians are going to have to take some steps before Grants Pass actually has an impact in the city. Now, there are 89 jurisdictions in the county of Los Angeles, 88 cities in the county. County of Los Angeles, led by our Board of Supervisors, doesn't have an anti-camping ordinance, but lots of the smaller jurisdictions do. I do want to say, and I think this is the single most important thing that I can say from a legal perspective, is that the ruling in Grants Pass was really narrow. It was about one specific provision of one specific amendment of the United States Constitution. And I personally have been litigating these issues for 10 years. There's been 5 days maybe in the past 10 years that I haven't had a lawsuit pending against the city of Los Angeles. And I've never brought it.
Wow.
We've filed lots and lots of lawsuits under other statutes and other provisions in the United States Constitution that Grants Pass has nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think cities should read this decision as permission to start criminalizing homelessness. Justice Sotomayor made it really clear. I also think Justice Gorsuch made it pretty clear that this decision was about that provision of the Eighth Amendment related to cruel and unusual punishment, but it said nothing about the 14th Amendment, nothing about the Fifth Amendment, you know, sort of my favorite amendments, which are the, you know, post-Civil War amendments. The Supreme Court, you know, didn't talk about the 14th Amendment at all. It wasn't implicated. And that has been one of the amendments that we've looked at frequently and turned to when fighting against the criminalization of homelessness. So
can you take 1 second to explain what that 14th Amendment and how you can use it?
Sure. Well, the 14th Amendment relates to the prohibiting or stripping people of their life, liberty, and property without due process. The idea behind that is there are certain limits on what the government can do, and there are certain limits on what the government can do without proper process. The 14th Amendment is oftentimes what we look at more broadly when we think about sort of the less delineated rights. We tend to think of the 14th Amendment. But it is also, it's a very strong amendment when it comes to protecting people's property interests. It's what we tend to sue under and what we're currently suing under related to unhoused folks' belongings. The Fourth Amendment has to do with protecting people's belongings. The other thing is we have a really strong constitution here in California. And, you know, this is about six justices' views of the United States Constitution. We often turn to the United States Constitution because it's available to us. It provides important protections, but by no stretch of the imagination is it the last stop in thinking about unhoused folks' civil rights. I'm thankful to Justice Sotomayor for reminding all of us of that. I think there's a lot of lawyers around the country who don't need that reminding. Certainly unhoused folks don't need that reminding, but on a day like Friday, it was pretty nice to see her very purposefully reminding all of us of that. And I hope cities are being reminded of that as well.
Yes, exactly. And just getting the word out there and maybe sparking some imagination. Well, we are out of time, darn it. So Attorney Shayla Myers, I did want you to give some information about where people can go to learn more.
Sure. I work at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. So we have information on our website about the Unhoused People's Justice Project. I also think organizations like the Los Angeles Community Action Network, Stop LAPD Spying, the National Lawyers Guild, do a lot of really good work on educating folks about these particular issues. There's also a lot of mutual aid organizations that are working with unhoused folks. And unhoused folks who are experiencing these things on a day-to-day basis are where we learn about really the heart and soul of these issues. So
thank you so much. And it is time to wrap. In closing, I want to again thank today's guests. We have, of course, Shayla Myers, attorney, and also earlier Marta Segura, LA's chief heat officer. Thanks also to the board op, our D'Angelo Jones, as well as everyone else at KPFK who are working tirelessly to keep these independent and free airwaves loud and strong. Until next week, this is Maria Hall with the Lawyers Guild Show.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2000.